The American version of The Office is one of the most watched shows on Netflix, especially now during the pandemic. The cult favourite sitcom put ordinary people front and centre and turned our shared experiences at work into something to laugh about. And Rolling Stone senior writer Andy Green talked to more than 80 members of the cast and crew for his new book, The Office: The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s, and Andy Green joins me now. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you. You're a music writer, so this is not your your usual sort of a book. I wonder why you decided to write a book about The Office, and I guess why you decided to do it this way, which is a kind of a curated collection of interviews.
Sure, yeah, I'm a huge music fan, but so many music things I care about, I've seen so many different books about, that I wanted something fresh and something that was untapped. And I randomly did a big oral history of the dinner party episode for Rolling Stone, and I had so much fun doing it, and I got so many great stories out of it. And I went to Amazon.com, searched The Office, and then saw nothing. And I realized it's this great untold story of this amazing show, and I felt compelled to sort of tell it myself.
The greatest sitcom of the 2000s. It's a pretty bold statement. What makes The Office worthy of that title?
It's a bold statement, but I really stand by it. I think that there's been so many great shows of the peak TV era of the past 15 years or so, but there's been very few great sitcoms. I love 30 Rock. I love Arrested Development. But I think The Office broke the form in so many ways and presented a sitcom in such a radically different way that it's the best. I think it's the funniest. I think it's the most, it's the best written. And I think it just sort of towers above all the others.
We got the UK version of The Office first here in New Zealand. So I want to speak on behalf of the people listening who are saying, hey, well, this is an idea from somewhere else. Can you tell us how and in what way the US Office sort of departed and I guess found its own path from its beginnings with the UK Office?
Sure, and the pilot of the US Office is almost a shot-for-shot remake of UK Office, and it's not nearly as funny. That Steve Carell was trying to do Ricky Gervais, and really it fell short. He came off cruel and just mean and not at all fun. And slowly they found a way to diverge. In the second season, they really focused on the Michael Scott character, who is the equivalent of David Brent on UK Office, on his loneliness and his vulnerability and his desperation for family and friends, and you started caring a lot more about him. You saw his heart, and David Brent, played by Gervais, was very funny, but you didn't really see his heart very much. So the U.S. Office is a bit more cuddly and a little less like cringe-inducing at times, I would say.
Yeah, although there is plenty of cringing in there. Is that an essential ingredient? And was The Office one of the first shows to do that?
Yeah, it was one of the first network shows, I would say, that they weren't afraid of silence, which for most sitcoms, that was the enemy. It was always just joke, joke, zinger, joke, joke. You know, it was so – if you view most sitcoms that were from the 50s to the early aughts, it's the same rhythm the entire time with the laugh track and with the music cues. And The Office killed all of that, and they let moments – just sit there and linger. The two characters stare at each other, and the tension would build as it was just second after second would pass in silence. And that's a very bold and brave thing, but done right, it's just hysterical.
We've been talking a bit on the show recently about how you can't separate art from its context, and that's even true of The Office. It came along when people were changing the ways in which they watch TV, right? How was that significant, and why was The Office the perfect show for that moment?
Yeah, it came on the air in the States in 2005. It came on in the UK in 2001. And this is the birth of the reality show. It's the birth of YouTube. It's the birth of people who are watching content in very different ways, shot at home, shot on the fly on an island or something. That's like Survivor. And then you see, and you see people talking to the camera about the emotional, just the content of that scene. And so that formula that we saw on Big Brother and Survivor and so many places, we saw it on The Office, and it was used for comedy. And that was very bold, and that wouldn't have really made sense to viewers before reality shows were commonplace.
Aaron Shore, one of the writers you spoke to, has a theory about The Office, and he thinks that 2005 is a really significant year, and part of what made The Office funny was who was in charge of America at the time.
Yeah, I think that's crucial. I think 2005 was a turning point for the country because in 04, it was like George W. Bush. He like won re-election. He was still very popular. And then in 05 was Katrina. And that's when a lot of Americans saw for the first time how inept this president was and how the people in charge, they didn't know what they were doing. And Michael Scott is a George W. Bush character. In so many ways, he's fumbling, he's inept, things are disastrous, but he wants to be your friend. He smiles, and he's strangely likable. That as much as you're irritated by everything he's doing, it's hard to despise him because part of you feels that he thinks he's doing the right thing. And so it was sort of a weird microcosm of America in the George W. Bush era.
Did the network execs have high expectations for The Office when it arrived?
I think they had high hopes, but this was coming off the era of must-see TV, where Frasier and Friends and Will and Grace and Seinfeld were these juggernaut shows that the entire country watched, and they would have tens of millions of viewers. And things were changing then. It was like cable was starting to like make great shows, and audiences were spending more and more time on the internet. But it was the start of that, so the network still thought it was possible to have a Friends or a Frasier, and a little show about a paper company in Scranton was sort of not the mainstream like kind of thing that they wanted. It's the anti-Friends in so many ways that they almost canceled it. It survived by the skin of its teeth.
Darker than anything that had come before, and also interestingly, darker than a lot of things that were to come. We talked to Michael Schur on the show recently, and his shows. I mean, he was involved in The Office too, but his shows, Parks and Rec, and The Good Place, have a certain brightness about them. The Office would almost stand out more in today's environment.
I mean, if you think about the basic premise of The Office, it's the mundane and often desperate lives of people at a struggling paper company in a dying Midwest town. That even the characters that are attractive and in love, they still work a job they hate. They still go to a really bland office each day and try and sell blank pieces of paper and put up and are working alongside morons and a stupid boss. That it's sort of a bleak look at life.
One review of your book, I'm not sure if you stay away from reviews, but anyways, it was a nice one. Made the point that only now can those quote halcyon days of workplace nothingness and the mundane seem extraordinarily special. You would never have guessed that we might feel nostalgic for a time when we could go into an office with other people, right?
I wrote this book in a very different time, and I never dreamed I would release it at a moment when the whole world was shutting down. But I think people are really flocking to The Office now. I'm sure on Netflix it's surging more than it usually is. And it's sort of, I think we all miss the world of going to an office and being annoyed by our coworkers and our boss. It's like this distant past now, it feels like.
I'm speaking with Rolling Stone senior writer Andy Green, who's author of the new book, The Office: The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s. So we're talking about the US version of The Office. Was it an instant hit, Andy?
I know, because the first season was just six episodes, and the ratings, they went down after every one. And the network then was run by Jeff Zucker, who now runs CNN, and he didn't like the show. And it was almost canceled, but the 40-year-old virgin opened that summer and was a monster comedy hit, and that made Steve Carell a star, and that was just enough to get NBC to buy 6 more episodes. And the second season, it was slowly rose through the ratings. It was a very gradual thing, but the show got big enough that they got a full third season, and it just kept going until the 9th season.
It's amazing how many shows have that story. Yeah, Star Trek was like that. Even the Seinfeld, when it was originally the Seinfeld Chronicles, it wasn't that well watched, and it shows you the rewards that can accrue when a network executive is patient enough to stick with something that shows promise. And you wonder how many shows got extinguished prematurely.
Yeah, it's very rare. It's this crazy system that networks commission so many pilots and they pay a fortune to make these shows. And a bunch of them, they don't even air once. And then several, they air once or twice, and then they're canceled. And someone told me that a sitcom is the making pancakes, that the first two ones, they don't really go well. That you need to keep going until you get the hang of it. And so it's sad to think of so many great shows that could have been, that were just snuffed out in the first season.
Part of what made the UK Office so great was the authenticity. Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant had both worked in offices. And we learned in your book that some of the cast of the US Office didn't give up their day jobs when they got their roles on this show.
Yeah, because with most network shows, they cast people who are really young and very attractive and very new, you know, to LA. But The Office, they wanted it to look like actual people who are working at a paper company in Scranton. So they cast people in their 40s, their 50s, or their 60s even. And some of them, they've been struggling to get their careers going for decades. So many of them, they were waitresses, they were nannies, they were working people just trying to find their big break. And during the first season, when they had no guarantee of the show lasting, they kept their jobs.
You make the point that The Office really is Steve Carell, and Steve Carell is The Office. Did anyone else come close to landing that lead role?
Yeah, it was offered to Paul Giamatti and to Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Wow.
Who were big movie stars then. And back in 2003 and 4 when that was happening, it was not seen as a good career move to go from movies to TV. It was seen as a lesser art form for actors who were not distinguished yet. And so they turned it down. And they thought about Dan Aykroyd or even Dave Chappelle or Cedric the Entertainer or Rick Moranis or Stephen Colbert. They thought of so many people. And the person who they really came the closest to was Bob Odenkirk, who they loved and he screen tested for days for it. And they came really close, but they thought his take on it was a little too dark, a little too menacing, that you couldn't see the heart shining through all of the cruelty, and they didn't give it to him.
No one that you spoke to has a bad word to say about Steve Carell, huh?
No, I spoke to almost 90 people, and even off the record, I didn't hear a single bad word about that man. They revere him. They love him. They saw him as their father figure on the set, as their leader, as their friend. He was, by all accounts, he's a fantastic guy.
And by the way, this seems like ancient history now, but during the fourth season, the writers went on strike. How did that change the show?
Well, it was a crazy thing. There was many months in the States where there weren't new shows, where the talk show hosts, they just came out and were just winging it. They had no cue cards. They had no writers. And many shows didn't survive, because if you lose that much momentum, if you're not seen by audience for months, you can be forgotten. But The Office then was strong enough to survive it. Steve Carell and Greg Daniels, the showrunner, they wrote personal checks to the crew, because the writers were on strike for better deals. But that meant that the boom mic guys and the painters and the caterers, they couldn't work. It was a very hard time.
One of the revelations in your book is that Steve Carell didn't actually really want to leave the show after 7 seasons. Well, what happened?
Yeah, I was shocked by that. I heard that once, and I dismissed it because I had heard the story a thousand times that he was burned out and he wanted to make movies, which makes sense. But
Yeah.
so many producers all told me this. There were people who would really know, and the casting director and the show's head producer, they all told me that he wasn't offered a new contract. And what happened is that Comcast bought NBC that time, and they got rid of Jeff Zucker. They brought in Bob Greenblatt to run the network, and they were in fourth place by this point. They'd gone from first place to fourth place in a few years, which is dead last. And the mandate of the new president of the network, he wanted big shows again. He wanted more Friends and Frasiers and Seinfelds. And their shows then were 30 Rock and Community and Parks and Rec and The Office, which were critically beloved, but didn't have, they didn't have huge ratings. Like the Big Bang Theory was just destroying them, and like Two and a Half Men and these cheesy sitcoms. And so he saw no reason to keep paying Steve Carell's salary and to keep the show alive that wasn't the kind of a big hit that he wanted. He earned his mark on the network, and he didn't offer him a new contract, which is crazy, but it's what happened.
Several actors were mooted to try and fill his shoes. Who was considered at that stage to be the next Michael Scott?
They thought about a lot of people, but the person they came closest to was James Gandolfini, which
Huh.
would have been incredible. You know, he what he had he was very desperate then to be seen as something besides Tony Soprano. So going on a goofy sitcom and doing the opposite of The Sopranos was very appealing to him. And they met with him and did a character that was all thought out, which sounds very funny to me when they told me about it. But at the last minute, he got cold feet. I think he realized that by the eighth season of a beloved show, that to step into that is very risky. It's sort of the comedy by that point was getting stale, and to replace Steve Carell was so hard that I think he realized that he couldn't do it. Whereas James Spader, he took it, and it didn't really go that well, I would argue.
And so now Steve Carell and the showrunner of The Office, Greg Daniels, have a new show on Netflix. It's coming out next month. It's called Space Force.
Yes.
You're coming out in May, actually. Is the DNA of The Office all over that new show?
Yeah, it's the two of them are the two most important people that were working on The Office. I mean, like Greg Daniels is the genius of the US Office. He is instrumental in its success, and he's so shy and so humble that he's not a household name. He does not do much press, but he's the reason that the show was as great as it was. And they have some writers on the show that worked on The Office. I'm psyched to see it. I think it's going to be great.
And do you have your fingers crossed for an office reunion at some point?
Would be fun, but those things are never satisfying. That you think you want more Mad About You, or you want more Arrested Development, or you want Dumb and Dumber 2, but then you see the thing, and after 2 minutes, it's like, oh God, they shouldn't have done this. You know, I think it's a time and a place, and I think to try and go back there, it just wouldn't be funny. I think it wouldn't work, and they shouldn't do it.
Before you go, you've written about some incredible people, a lot of musicians, and I wonder if you've learnt any lessons about telling the stories of musicians, interviewing them, getting the best out of them in your long career with Rolling Stone. Anything you can share with us?
Yeah, I think don't be afraid of silence. The same thing as on The Office. If you ask a question of somebody important and they give a short answer, you just sort of sit there for a minute and just let the silence build until they fill it. And that's always a technique I try for my interviews.
Great. Possibly more effective in print than in a live TV interview,
Yeah,
but
I
a
think on
good a good
TV
tip.
or on the radio it would be death, but when you're at a restaurant, it's a very different thing.
Fantastic. Hey, well, thanks for putting your talent and energies into this project. The book is called The Office: The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s, and the author is Andy Green, who's been with us chatting today. Thanks for your time, Andy.
Thank you so much.